everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. Because we decided this was a thing, for the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool.
You don't get to pick your own nickname, Whitney. Other people have decided to adopt it.
I think I did pick that one,
but
at one
they
point
didn't have to take
as,
it
as a bit of a joke. But yeah, it's
look,
took it and ran with it.
We've all tried to give ourselves a nickname, like yeah, my name is Nitro, but other people have to decide whether or not they're willing to call you that. So you may put forth a nickname, but if it's up to others to decide if it's a thing, people decided that you feel like a Rockmeister McCool, and I think that's fair. But
hey,
yeah,
hey bandmates, I want you to call me Sting. I call you Sting.
Anyway, this is the podcast here at the Critically Acclaimed Network where you write us emails and then we read your emails and then we answer your questions or respond to your criticisms or we recommend movies or TV or whatever you want us to talk about, really. We're pretty much open books. We get a lot of emails. We're very grateful for it, but we don't have time for all of them. So we try to just jump right in. If you want to write us an email for this episode's a bit too late. We're recording it now. I don't know how you'd hear me before we finish recording.
We don't know. They might have time travel.
If you do, I'm very impressed. But if you would care to email us for a future episode, our email is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We would love to hear from you. We don't have time for all of them, so let's just jump right in. Whitney, tell us about our very first email.
Our first email comes from Graham. Hello, Graham.
Hi, Graham.
Hey, Bibbs, and I'm going to mispronounce this. Carrigmeister McCummel? It's Irish, and I don't know how to pronounce Irish. So
there you go.
I just did it phonetically, and I apologize for everything I did wrong. This is the closest Irish translation to Rockmeister McCool that I could find, from Ireland. I'm a huge fan of your work. I've even written in before, and it's always a delight, even when I know I disagree with some of your opinions.
Yeah, fair.
That's totally fair.
We're often wrong.
All the time.
Oh, yeah.
But as I've said before, it's
it's not a contest.
It's not a critic's job to agree with you, and it's not your job to agree with the critic.
Yep.
So
we're all just talking.
It's just to communicate. My question is, have you guys ever watched proper Irish films? Mm. And what are your thoughts on them? Films like Wolfwalkers, The Book of Kells, Boys from County Hell, Erect, or The Cured? I say this because we as a country never come up in the cinematic conversations unless we're portrayed as drunken fools or rebels fighting against the English or at times ourselves. We have a deep history and lore that is rarely touched upon, and we have stories that rival or surpass any other kind of fiction out there. I was hoping to get your thoughts and maybe interest you in our stories as well. Don't mention that Artemis Fowl adaptation.
we won't.
Cheers, Graham Day, and directed by an Irish director as well.
Kenneth Branagh
is Irish.
I forgot about that. Mm. So we actually had a question in a recent episode where we were asked about our favorite British films, and I think they mentioned Irish films too, and I think we kind of failed to answer that part of the question, so I'm glad it's come up again. Again, there's cinema from pretty much every country in the world, and unfortunately not all of it reaches our shores or does with enough fanfare that anyone notices, and a lot of it can just feel like it can get really, really lost if you don't have a guide.
And I've actually made it kind of a goal of mine to start seeing more movies from countries I haven't seen them from before.
Yeah.
Like I saw a Nigerian film. I saw a film from Lesotho earlier this year. I've seen a goodly number of Irish films, but I think it's safe to say that I am no expert.
Same.
But I have seen, and I'm not just going to talk about like Jim Sheridan or Stephen Frears or Neil Jordan. Like those three, I think, are like the most famous Irish filmmakers.
Yeah.
Who make films set in Ireland that make their way over here to the United States.
I would recently add John Michael McDonagh.
What is John Michael McDonagh?
John Michael McDonagh did, he did two films I'm very, very fond of. He did The Guard with Don Cheadle and Brendan Gleeson.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a very, very good mismatched buddy cop movie that goes in directions you don't expect that genre to go.
Hmm.
Just truly excellent. And he did a really great movie that I was convinced was going to get Brendan Gleeson a Best Actor nomination called Calvary. About a priest who in the confessional tells the father that he's going to be killed in a week, and he doesn't know who was in that confessional and who said that, and he's interrogating everyone in his town trying to figure out like who's got it in for him. And boy, is it great! It's dark. And it's really depressing, and it's incredibly thoughtful and smart. And Brendan Gleeson is just chef's kiss astounding in that movie. Like, really should have been nominated and maybe won. Like, he's really, really great. So I'm a fan. John Michael McDonagh is, I believe, he's the brother. Yeah, he's the brother of Martin McDonagh, who's a little bit more famous. He did 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. 7 Psychopaths. I'm not a fan of either of those movies. He also did In Bruges, which is quite good.
It's pretty good.
I like it a lot. It's
got some good stuff in it. Irish film, at least as it tends to break out internationally. If you go back throughout the history of Hollywood, there are a lot of Irish co-productions, but they were made with like American or British money.
Yeah, it's always
so
tricky.
You're going back to stuff like Darby O'Gill and The Little People.
Or
and,
The Quiet Man, which is quite charming. But whether those are proper Irish, known as
like a John Wayne movie rather than an Irish film necessarily.
That's often the case where there's like one like American actor. Like there's an Irish film I'm very fond of from 1995. Directed by Pat O'Connor, called Circle of Friends.
Circle of Friends is a good one.
It was a bit of a breakout movie in the mid-90s. It starred Colin Firth and Minnie Driver and Saffron Burroughs and Chris O'Donnell, for some reason.
Oh, O'Donnell, he's got an Irish name.
I guess he does. he was the American in the cast. It's quite a lovely film, actually, and it actually deals with like some real... real issues, and it's just a good sort of I don't know if I call it a coming of age film, but it's just an excellent like young romance movie. Quite fond of that.
The first film that I think like not first Irish production I saw, but the first film that was like definitely from Ireland and about Irish people that I saw as sort of an adolescent was My Left Foot. Jim Sheridan film, and it's about Christy Brown, an author who famously, I think he had ALS. He couldn't move his body; he could only move his foot, and he ended up becoming a very famous author just by writing with his left foot.
Yeah,
and so it's about sort of his struggles growing up, and it was his life story, and that's a really, really good movie. Daniel Day-Lewis, is really wonderful in it. Fiona Shaw's in it. Brenda Fricker's in it, and. That film, I think, was part of like the big indie boom, and we started getting a lot of like international imports. So we started to see a lot of Irish imports, like right in that period, like throughout the early 90s. That's when we heard The Commitments and Into the West and Hear My Song.
The Commitments was a big one for me. I was a huge
Jim Sheridan film in the Name of the Father. Stephen Frears' The Snapper was around that time.
We started getting more of Neil Jordan, who was a big breakout director here. He did Interview the Vampire, which is his biggest American production. But he also did a film, it's really dark, but it's excellent. You ever see The Butcher Boy?
Yeah.
The Butcher Boy is good.
The Butcher Boy is really good. It's kind of sick, but
it's
that's kind of the
sick.
Point.
No, it's a movie about... like a child or a young boy who's actually like sort of retreating into these sort of violent fantasy worlds. And, it's a twisted film, but it's really, really well made. It's like the film in his like filmography that is, I think everyone agrees is excellent, but doesn't get talked about very often because it's not fun. It's really, really good. So that's definitely
Neil Jordan. Neil Jordan's probably best known for The Crying Game, but he also did Michael Collins. He did The Butcher Boy. His last film was pretty awful one with Isabelle Huppert, Greta.
I kind of like Greta. Greta was kind of a...
Greta was not great.
Greta reminded me of a William Castle movie where it's just like, hey, we're just going to do something kind of sleazy and terrible, but we're going to get like a really great older actress to give a deliciously unhinged performance. And that's what we got.
Look, I will not turn down any opportunity to watch Isabelle Huppert act. There's a wonderful scene where she spits gum into Chloe Grace Moretz's hair. And that's a pretty fun scene. But
it's fun. I find that movie very entertaining. But is it great? No, of course not.
But Neil Jordan, if you're a horror movie fan, he did The Company of Wolves, which is a really good werewolf, yep. One of the great werewolf movies, because there aren't a lot.
Not as many as you think.
One of his more biggest movies in the 80s was Mona Lisa. I did not like We're No Angels. He's done some bad ones as well.
Oh, yeah, We're No Angels isn't. It has a great, like, kind of comedy twist where, like, something gets misheard in the most perfect way possible. I actually really like that bit, but it's not great. We also mentioned in the email is the work of Tom Moore, who co-founded the Cartoon Saloon with Nora Twomey and Paul Young. And Cartoon Saloon is responsible for some of the best animated movies of the last, like, 12 years.
Yeah, Secret of Kells, Wolfwalkers, and
Song of the Sea. Yeah.
Which are all based in Irish folklore and deal with a lot of Irish iconography.
Yeah.
Of those, I think my favorite is The Book of Kells. But they're Secret all Kells. Good. Or Secret of Kells. Yeah. But yeah,
Secret of Kells is really astoundingly good. Beautifully animated. Mm. Like, it's just absolutely incredible. Song of the Sea, I think, is a little underrated. I think it came in, like, the middle there. Yeah. But it's really, really just emotionally, like, riveting. And I'm a huge fan of Wolfwalkers.
Yeah.
I think Wolfwalkers I
know you're very fond of that.
Wolfwalkers hit me, like, right in the heart. Like, it's exactly what I wanted at the time. So yeah, I'm a big fan of Tom Moore. But, yeah, there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of, like, Irish filmmakers who I'm, like, I don't know if their films count as Irish movies, depending on where they were made. You know, you look at, like, lists of Irish movies, and maybe it'll include something like Excalibur, but, like, is that actually an Irish movie? Yeah, like, I don't know.
Like, some of these are, like, co-productions, or they were filmed in Ireland, or, like, technically, that Dragon movie, Reign of Fire, that's an Irish production.
Technically.
I mean, it's a big, dumb American science fiction post-apocalyptic blockbuster with dragons and Matthew McConaughey.
That was the movie I saw to celebrate that I had just, like, the day that I found out I got into film school. That was the movie I saw to celebrate, Reign of Fire. That was new in theaters at the time. And I was like, I want to see this dragon movie. And the dragon movie was like, it's kind of stupid, actually, but I had a good time.
So yeah, I have seen numerous Irish films. I can't speak to which ones sort of express like Irish national character or about
that's patriotism,
other than the ones that sort of deal directly with Irish history.
But to the accuracy of that, we could not say.
Well, I would love to hear from some other Irish listeners what you think are sort of the best or the most emblematic Irish movies, which I know is a difficult thing to do.
I forgot. There was a good Irish horror movie that came out a couple, like, I think last year. Was it Sea Fever?
Sea Fever.
Yeah, it came out about a year ago. That's a really, really creepy aquatic horror film about a fishing boat that, like,
it's
runs afoul of, like, a weird parasite in the middle of the ocean.
It's an alien knockoff, but it's a really good
one.
It's kind of low-key and very scary.
There's a couple of, like, body horror elements in that movie that generally make me go, yeah, no, thank you, oh God. Like, just really gross. So, kudos for that. But hopefully that answers your question. Let's move on. Thank you for asking.
I'm trying to explore the world cinematically.
Yeah.
Here is a letter from, let's see here, MJ.
Hi, MJ.
Hello, MJ. Hey, Bibbs and Whitney. Hope you guys are doing well. As an animation fan, I have a lot of affection for the Looney Tunes, but zero love or tolerance toward the first Space Jam, with the exception of its admittedly sweet soundtrack.
Yeah, it was the best-selling soundtrack.
Come on and slam.
Yeah, this is the Space Jam.
Quad City All-Stars. As a concept, it's cynical, shallow, and does not respect the spirit of the original Looney Tunes shorts. Just to provide some context, I was 4 when the first Space Jam came out, and even as a little kid, I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed the various Looney Tunes shorts that aired on the Cartoon Network. So when the sequel finally came around, I decided to give it a fair chance. I figured that if movies like The Lego Movie or Wreck-It Ralph managed to exceed my expectations, maybe they might do something clever with the Space Jam sequel. But when the more and more clips of the film came out, from the excessive amounts of references to other Warner Brothers IP, to the cringe-inducing rap battle, what little hope I had for the movie was snuffed out like a candle. So I watched this movie this weekend on HBO Max as I took a break from editing an episode of my own podcast called Pointcast, a Pinky in the Brain podcast.
Ooh! That's cool.
Traws. And while A New Legacy has some nice 2D animation, and the Looney Tunes themselves are a bit better than they were in the first one, the whole movie is a cynical cash grab that not only banks on nostalgia, but banks on excessive and shameless flaunting of corporate properties. All accurate. Yes. And that leads to another big issue I have with the movie. This is how lazy the pop culture references are here. That's not to say I'm against media catered towards kids having nods to adult movies and shows. Some of my favorite cartoons were able to put in many clever references that older viewers would enjoy. Like the old Looney Tunes, for instance.
You know, Animaniacs did that a lot. They did a whole Apocalypse Now episode. Mm. I'm like, your target demo has not seen that movie yet. Or at least they shouldn't have.
I remember seeing an interview with the makers of Freakazoid, who's the same team who did Animaniacs. And they did an entire segment that was Hello Dolly.
Yeah.
And they sang, like, song. They couldn't license the song, so they kind of wrote the music, so it sounds kind of like Hello Dolly, but it's about a villain called the Loeb, who has a brain for a head. And they said, yeah, we decided to do a Hello Dolly episode. And he thought for a minute, because kids love Hello Dolly.
Yeah.
So that's something my wife and I still say to each other. Why is this in there? Oh, because kids love that.
Yeah, kids love Ken Russell's The Devils.
Kids love A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
But some examples here. Phineas and Ferb had a lot of funny references to adult movies and TV shows. Gravity Falls featured some cool homages to other horror movies.
Yep.
There are entire episodes of Pinky and the Brain that spoofed all the older movies like The Third Man and Man of La Mancha. Freakazoid parried Hello Dolly, there it is, in a hilarious 4-minute-long musical number. Hey, one SpongeBob SquarePants episode made numerous references to Nosferatu that stuck with me for years. And when I finally discovered the movie, I was like, hey, that's the guy from the SpongeBob episode. Even the original Looney Tunes cartoons had satirical takes on movies and actors from the time period. But there's a difference between loving homages or carefully crafted satire to other media simply shoving Looney Tunes characters into other WB movies in a lazy edited montage or a random Rick and Morty cameo just so the audience can say, oh yeah, Warner Brothers owns that. An additional nitpick is that while there are cameos for family-friendly cartoons such as the Animaniacs and various Hanna-Barbera cartoons, the movie could have had more mileage with referencing those shows beyond merely being mere spectators at a big game. When I first saw the blurry images of the Warner siblings in the trailer, I was hoping that Pinky and the Brain would have made a cameo, preferably in some clever twist where Don Cheadle's character would have been a giant robot or a computer program operated by the mice in another attempt to take over the world.
Oh my god, that would have been great!
Alas, that was not the case.
That would have been such a treat! Honestly, just even that, just like, you think about it, like, we never really got to see Yakko, Wakko, and Dot interact with Bugs.
That would have been nice. Well,
why have we never seen that? Like, come on, this is a great opportunity. At least give them a moment, you know?
And we got to see Yakko, Wakko, and Dot. Where are the Tiny Toons? They should have been in there.
Should have been in there.
Nobody likes the Tiny Toons anymore.
That bugs me. Babs is a cultural icon, damn it.
Babs, Buster, Plucky, and Hampton, like the central quad, are all... I could relate to all of those people.
Yeah, all right.
Those animals, those characters.
Yeah, they're people.
Animal people.
Yeah.
And my final piece of criticism is how the movie did not properly credit some of its artists, including Dave Alvarez. I respect the effort that animators put into the movie, but it's a shame that some of the artists involved are not receiving the credit they deserve.
That sucks.
They say, like, these are Warner Brothers characters, but there's no acknowledgement... This is me talking now. There's no acknowledgement of the history of those characters at all.
Like, who created this character? Like, that should be, like...
Shouldn't you, like, credit Bob Clampett and Robert McKimson and Friz Freleng and Chuck Jones?
Damn right you should.
And all of those filmmakers from the 40s and 50s who kind of, like, invented the way these characters operate and relate to us? Yeah. But anyway... overall, I would not call Space Jam A New Legacy a good movie. It's not the worst movie ever. It's arguably better than the first Space Jam, but it's a morally bankrupt film filled with trite cliches and shameless promotion of a giant corporation. Some people appreciate it for being dumb, and that's fine, but excusing the shallowness as it's just a kid's movie does a disservice to children, because they deserve more films with substance and engaging themes, too. I hope you enjoyed reading my criticisms on film, and I hope you too, Kate. Take care. Sincerely, MJ.
MJ, thank you so much. Anything else? Is there an OPS or anything? Okay. Thank you for that. You echo a lot of our sentiments. I don't know if you had already heard our podcast review on Critically Acclaimed, but we agree with pretty much everything you said there. I even agree that technically, on a technical level, it's a little better than the original Space Jam. The animation is sharper. There's more jokes that work. The plot hangs a little better. But yeah, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to put this. Some movies are bad and it's okay. Some movies are bad and it's not okay. Yeah. And the difference is not, or should not be, your own personal connection to the material. You know, it's not just like, well, I happen to like this character, so I don't care if it's crap and has a terrible message. For me, what it boils down to is, does it feel like this movie, in its badness and its failure to do something interesting or productive or creative or, you know, anything like that, does it have the capacity to do actual harm?
It's giving you a bad idea.
Yeah, is it presenting a bad perspective? A perspective that is actually unhealthy, either on a personal level, and of course that's subjective, but we're allowed to have those opinions. Or maybe in the case of something like Space Jam, where it's presenting, here's how you should look at corporations. And honestly, we should be questioning that. Yeah, and we should not just be looking at, like, oh yes, Warner Brothers is, you know, they're the keeper of all of these wonderful universes. And I'm like, great. What are you doing with them? Space Jam: A New Legacy? Not great.
Yeah.
You're not a caretaker right now. You're actually just exploiting them. And again, all or most of these were like studio products to begin with, made within the studio system. They were made to make money, but they weren't made exclusively for that purpose. At least not all of them. So many of them were made people who really cared about what they were doing.
They're taking a lot of the art out of these characters, and they're taking them out of their stories. And when we see them out of context, you know, just seeing Fred Flintstone standing there is meaningless.
Yeah.
And we're meant to feel a thrill. They're exploiting our pop culture familiarity with these things in order to sell a ticket to something that is ultimately incredibly empty. And I think that's an incredibly bad message to be sending to kids.
Many of them are willing to buy it.
That you need to be excited about these characters just because they are there. Get excited because they represent this canon of characters that a studio owns. And it's emblematic of actually a really unfortunate trend. A lot of people are comparing Space Jam to Ready Player One, because those are both sort of big pop culture mashup movies where characters owned by many different companies appear on screen together. Oh, look, there's Goro from Mortal Kombat, and the alien comes out of its chest. Isn't that a hoot? Here's a car chase with all these famous cars from movies.
All references, no context.
Exactly. That movie is about essentially trying to ally yourself with a white Gen Xer and the kind of shit that they watch.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly self-serving. It insults guys my age.
The most philosophically transcendent thing you can do is figure out a guy who watched a lot of cartoons in the early 90s.
Yeah, more or less. He was really into Space Invaders and Joust and Back to the Future.
Yeah.
His favorite movie was The Shining. Wow, that's...
What does that signify?
A lot of people like that movie. That's just not really unique to him. Anyway, but the ultimate message of that was the bad guy wanted to buy all of these characters and then put ads in front of them. That was the big sin of Ready Player One.
He wanted to fill the screen with advertising. And then the movie ends with literally like this like giant like torrential wave of advertising
for all these characters.
All these intellectual properties from everywhere all over the globe. You've got characters from Overwatch and the Smurfs and Back to the Future and
Chucky's
all this stuff
in there,
and they're only there they're there because they could get them, but they're only there because they figured putting them in there would sell you them.
It's
just doing the thing and it's exactly like Space Jam in that the existence of the movie is the villain.
Yeah.
Like what the villain is trying to do, we have to stop the villain from doing basically making Space Jam: A New Legacy or making Ready Player One. Then there's no self-awareness. There's no understanding of their own hypocrisy.
Indeed. And both those movies are about how grand it is to ally yourself with the company.
Yeah.
The corporation is good, actually. Yeah. What the two sides are fighting for are two different companies. Both gigantic corporations, let's call them Apple and Microsoft in the case of Ready Player One. Microsoft wants to have ads. Apple does not. So we better fight for Apple. That's what they're doing. They're on the battlefield fighting and killing for the company and who gets ownership of the company.
That's
horrible. I think it's Space Jam, though, might be a little bit more in line with something like Saving Mr. Banks. And you and I are on record for how much we hate Saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah.
All of the flashback stuff with P.L. Travers, that would have made a good movie.
That's good stuff, actually. Like, Rachel Griffiths and Colin Farrell are really good in that film.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And all of the things about Walt Disney is sickeningly self-serving.
Yeah.
Because the ultimate message of that film is, no, Disney was made the right choice in deliberately mistreating the property of the author who didn't want to sell it to them.
And the author.
Yeah.
And the author herself. She did not know what to do with her own stuff until Disney bought it.
Disney knows her stuff better than she does. And she keeps, throughout that film too, they say that, I know what this is. This is based on something really, really personal.
Yeah.
Stop trying to take it away from me and turn it into the schlock that you do. And Walt Disney says, okay, I'll treat it very respectfully. And then he made it into schlock against her own wishes.
Yeah, it's good schlock. Well, I think we've all seen Mary Poppins and we can acknowledge that it's a well-made movie, but it's not what she intended. It's not what the author cared about.
I like it less after seeing Saving Mr. Banks, actually.
Having read the books when I was a kid, I remember I interviewed the writer of Saving Mr. Banks, and I talked about the difference between the movie and the books, and they made the point to me that, like, well, how many have you ever read the books? And I'm like, yes. And they pointed out that most people haven't. Mm. And that's pretty true. Most people's awareness of Mary Poppins is based on the movie. And I'm going to say two things to that. One, that's sad. And not because it's a bad movie, but because it has erased the thing that gave it its existence. The version of the thing, like we created something that's so beautiful, Disney wanted to make a movie about it. Mm. Okay, great. And then Disney made a movie about it. And erase that thing from the cultural, like, from a cultural awareness, and then made a movie bragging about it.
About how they, well,
and they were right to do so. Bragging
about it, yeah, that they were in the right to do so. So
is that a dick move.
I feel like that's what Space Jam was doing. It's, we have all these things. We can do whatever we want.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
We can just shove them all together, and we own them. And aren't you lucky that a company cares enough about you to put everything you love in one spot? It's like, God. Fuck you. Yeah,
is it the worst movie ever made? Not from like a perspective of just watching it, but in terms of its sort of conceptualization, one could argue that it's down there.
It's down.
It's all a matter of what you value. It's all a matter of what matters to you. I would argue that the worst movie ever made isn't necessarily the most inept movie ever made. It's a movie that makes you worse for watching it.
Yeah.
And I think that's there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot of subjectivity to that, but that's where my head is at. Anyway.
That said, I have seen movies that have reprehensible morals that I still really enjoy.
Oh yeah,
case in point is Taken. That's the one I bring up. That is a movie that has like no moral heart whatsoever, and it's like actively advocates for violence.
Yeah,
in a very real world sort of way, and like reinforces a lot of really bad ideas that like fantasy, like dad fantasies about getting revenge on the people from other countries are going to snatch your daughter. It's like all these horrible fantasies are being played into.
You're not wrong.
I kind of hope that most audiences are smart enough to see that and recognize how bad that is and enjoy themselves nonetheless.
It's okay to enjoy problematic material as long as you're not like stuffing wads of cotton in your ears and saying, no, there's nothing problematic about it. Like, no, you just have to be willing to have that conversation out of yourself. All right, this thing doesn't work, or this part of this movie that's a classic or considered a classic is outdated or sexist or has some other problem with it that's kind of hard to get behind, but so much of the rest of it's really, really good. And so, yeah, it's not about like pretending that's not a thing. It's about acknowledging that that's a thing and appreciating that there's complexity here and that we're going to like some stuff about some movies and dislike some stuff about others. And you know, we decide for ourselves when a line gets crossed, I suppose. Anyway, let's move on.
All right. Here's a letter from Myriad.
Hello.
And it's spelled M-A-I-R-E-A-D, so I apologize if I mispronounced that. Dear Lieutenant Bibbiani and Rock Monsignor MacLumbo, really loved your recent commentary track for Murder by the Book. This is a commentary track that you and I did for essentially the Columbo pilot that was directed by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, that's available on our Patreon page if you want to listen to that.
I was hoping perhaps you'd consider doing some others, or even better, adding Columbo to your roster of regular podcasts. Columbo was a really important show to me when I was growing up. It was very popular in Scotland, where we saw it very much as a critique of the Reaganomics/Thatcherism policy of the rich being allowed to get away with whatever they wanted, while the working class were often ignored. The working class schlub hero of the show, ignored and underestimated, besting his quote, betters. Every episode was always something to look forward to. This is a formula we could subscribe to. Definitely ahead of its time on that. I'd love to hear your views on the show going forward, especially the class element, which seems to me, as an outsider to the U.S., was rarely addressed on mainstream television. And although it's not a direct adaptation, I think it's definitely the best version of Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment in any format.
We actually talked about that in the commentary. Yeah,
I'd have added it to the also-rans in your recent literary classics episode.
Oh, that's
one of our
point,
listicle
yeah.
episodes. Such a fan of your in-depth discussions. Thank you for being my movie angels as I copied with lockdowns these past months. Warmest regards, Myriad.
Thank you so much for writing in. And we've actually had a really positive response to that commentary. That was part of our Your Critically Acclaimed series, where our highest tier patrons get to sponsor an episode. And we're at a point now where, in order to crank those out faster, we're encouraging everyone to pitch commentary tracks, because it's more efficient for us to record those. But we did a commentary track for... wasn't technically the first ever Columbo, because they did some TV movies. But when they took Columbo from TV movies to a regular series, the first episode that they aired was a real corker of a mystery that was written by Stephen Bochco and directed by a young Steven Spielberg before he had made Duel and broken into the feature film market. I had never seen Columbo before. I'd heard the legends, I've definitely seen the references, but for whatever reason, it was just never on TV when I was watching it, and so I never really got caught up in it. And Columbo's great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a hoot. I had a great time recording that commentary track with you. It was fun. This is not the first feedback that we've had about that commentary track asking us to do more Columbo. I will say this. We've got a lot on our plates, and there's a lot of Columbo out there. But I won't say that we won't do Columbo. What I will say is this. If you want us to do Columbo as our, in our critically acclaimed way, where we like review every single episode ever in order, that would definitely probably have to be a Patreon thing, because that's a lot, you know, bit more effort. But let us know. If you would like us, probably won't do commentary tracks for all of them, probably just do podcasts, but let us know if you would like us to do Columbo. And if we get enough people saying they would, especially if they would sign up if they haven't already, we would definitely do that, because it's fun. And we love doing podcasts, don't we?
We sure do a lot of them.
Yeah. But like, seriously, if there's something we can do by popular demand, well, why wouldn't we? Especially if we like the idea, and, you know, watching Columbo ain't no chore. So there you go.
Although there's like hundreds of Columbos, dude. There's like a lot of, and they were long.
I know.
That's a lot to take on.
It's a lot to take on. Actually, hold on. I wonder if I can find out just exactly how many Columbos there are.
It's like you look up the years on Columbo. It's like, oh, it started. But it went on for like 30 years.
No. You're exaggerating it. It's actually only 69 episodes of Columbo. Because it was on for forever, but it was part of a sick. It was a show.
So weekly movie kind of
thing. Where basically what happened was the network, NBC, would alternate the show that they showed every single week. So one week it would be Columbo, another week it would be, I don't know, McMillan and Wife or something. And so even though it was on for forever, they only did like one episode a month. So it actually isn't that bad. So there's 10 seasons of Columbo, but there's only 69 episodes. And if there's only 69 episodes, screw it. Let's track down Mrs. Columbo. Might as well add it in there. Give it a try.
Kate Mulgrew.
Yeah. But yeah, but again, we'll only do this if we get enough people actually asking us to do it. So find us on Twitter. We're at Critic Acclaim. And just tweet us and just say, hey, give us Columbo. And
we want Columbo, and
if we get enough people, especially people who would, you know, they say you would consider joining the Patreon, we would totally do more Columbo.
Absolutely.
As it stands, you know, we got a lot on our plate right now, and it's hard to prioritize something new. But if a lot of people ask for it, I guess we'd have to.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Next letter.
Sure.
Hey, here's a letter from Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Dear Bibs and Not Bibs. Well, I guess that's me, isn't it?
Well,
we should get T-shirts. Yours says Bibs, and mine says Not Bibs.
Oh. No, we should have yours say Bibs and mine says Not Bibs and really mess with everyone's heads.
Yeah, really. Yeah. And I'll have to practice your voice. We can do each other's voices. Because if people have never seen us in person, maybe
that's
they
true.
Don't know who's who.
I don't know if I do your voice. You're a bit more gravelly. I'm Please don't. I can't.
Do that.
Do you mind trying to do a Bibs?
Oh no, I can't.
Introduce a podcast like me.
Oh no, I would. Yeah. I would never.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Come on, try it. Try it. Come on. No, I dare you. Right, I dare you. Okay, fine.
I'll not embarrass myself or you.
That's the whole point. All right.
I know.
Back to the letter.
Letter. I'm a big fan of trivia quizzes, and one of the websites I use has been running a series of quizzes about LGBT characters on TV. And it's been a useful gateway for me in finding shows that I didn't even know had such representation in the first place.
Hmm.
More importantly, though, it's given me an idea. I have an extremely homophobic aunt.
Oh, dear.
Well, boo. Who visits and watches shows with me from time to time. And one of my favorite pastimes recently has been to sneak shows with LGBT characters into the lineup. Usually if she catches a whiff of anything remotely gay, she'll demand I turn it off immediately. But I figured out a way around this. I first noticed it with the podcast Welcome to Night Vale, whose narrator slash main character is gay. But this information wasn't revealed until many, many episodes in, and by that point she was so wrapped up in the story that she was willing to, as she put it, put up with it in order to continue listening.
Oh my god.
Put up with other human beings. What a chore. I tested this strategy with The Owl House, one of the shows I found through the aforementioned quiz website.
Love this show so much. We just started watching this recently. It's great.
Oh, well, you started watching it. I haven't seen it.
Oh, sorry. Me and Michelle, we both started watching it. It's great.
It's a wonderful animated fantasy on the Disney Channel, of all places, with a bisexual main character.
Yep.
Whose sexuality isn't really made obvious until much later in the show.
Mm.
The most recent episode even features a very explicitly romantic subplot between two girls that culminates with one kissing the other. And upon seeing it, much to my surprise, my aunt didn't become enraged and quit watching because she was still really wanted to know where the story was going. I consider this a victory. My question to you and to the listeners, then, is this. Are there any TV shows with compelling plots or characters that feature LGBT characters, but don't make that explicit until a decent way into the show? This may be only my opinion, but I find tricking bigots into accidentally being exposed to positive representation to be a hoot and a half, and I'm happy to do this as much as I can get away with it, even if it ultimately doesn't change their minds. Sincerely yours, Jack.
First off, Jack. Look, bravo!
Bravo!
Seriously, what a great work you're doing. That's
it's noble that you're trying, and it's horrible that people still have to live with these bigots, especially if you are in a place where you are queer yourself and you have to live with them, or you know this whole tragedy of not being able to live as who you are. I hope you can come here and listen to us because we want you here and we love you and. As for shows on TV series that sort of spring the gay on you, as it were, I'm trying to think of something. I know there have been a few recent animated shows that introduced queer elements later in them. I'm not at all familiar with a TV series called Steven Universe.
I know there's a
character. There's two female characters that end up becoming lovers on that show, but like later into the show.
Well,
right?
it's a little more complicated because the nature of that show is weird. But yes, basically yes. And that's a great one. It's a wonderful show. And
isn't that also true of Adventure Time, where there's two female characters that end up having an affair?
I didn't finish watching Adventure Time, but it's my understanding. Yeah. Also. Yeah. They kind of only did it like right at the end, which is a little disappointing. But Avatar: The Legend of Korra,
I was going to bring that up on that note as well.
I wish they'd done it a little sooner so that we could have actually enjoyed that their part of their characters more before the series ended. Yeah. But yes, I mean obviously we enjoyed the characters regardless, but we could have enjoyed them being open. You know, would have been nice.
This is a book, but Harold Hutchins. Of George Beard and Harold Hutchins, the creators of Captain Underpants, in the canon of Captain Underpants, there's some time travels. There's a time travel story in the 12th book, the final book in the series, where you get to see them as adults and who they married. And Harold married another man, and it's just completely incidental. So there's no reference to his sexuality otherwise, because there's a little kid throughout most of it. But that's like a kid's book. I'm not sure if your aunt would be reading that.
The sitcom Brooklyn Nine-Nine is very funny, and the character of Rosa Diaz, played by Stephanie Beatriz, I don't think they confirmed. She confirms that she's bisexual.
She uses the word bisexual.
She uses the word bisexual too. Like, but that's like not until like season 4 or 5.
Okay.
Like it's a long wait to get to that one.
This is a fun prank to play on a bigot.
Well,
I suppose like getting them involved, but what really needs to happen is just for them to watch a queer story.
Yeah.
Something that is openly and explicitly queer and, you know,
and not be in the mindset to immediately reject that out of hand. You know, again, we have to like break down the walls and sometimes they don't all break down in one go. So I understand. So the idea of easing them into it might make a lot of sense. And especially with someone maybe who's had like a real long lifetime of not being challenged.
Yeah, prejudice and bigotry.
Yeah. It's tricky and, you know, it would be real, real nice if there was some like definite easy way to do this for every single person. Cause then we could do that. Yeah. And then people would just be maybe more open-minded and chill. And yeah, it's hard.
It's difficult to say now because, advertising has become so specialized. And algorithms are sort of like changing ads to fit what you're watching and consuming and clicking on. It's difficult to say how many of these ads might be penetrating nationwide, but I have been seeing a lot more queer couples in just commercials. There's I saw an ad recently. It was, I think it was for like Metamucil or something really completely mundane. And it featured two men in their 60s in bed together. Mm. This like old married couple. And it was present. These two guys were just having, oh, yes, I think we should both take Metamucil. Yes, I think we should both take Metamucil. It's like, I don't care. I don't want to watch this Metamucil ad. But look, queer representation in something as mundane as a TV ad.
Yeah, the idea
I think
that it's...
That is actually a lot more useful than maybe something like trying to... force your bigoted aunt through something like Love, Simon.
The idea of just like having representation be so commonplace that it's no longer something that even raises an eyebrow, and it's just like, and we're all here and it's cool. Mm. Like, that is a goal we'd like to get to at some point, but we're, you know, the last representation isn't there yet, unfortunately.
I would rather pull the bigot aside and say, you're the one who needs to catch up. It's not our job to track where you are in the back.
Mm-hmm.
We're up here in the front. Catch up. And we had a conversation recently with David Alonso about Hallmark movies and the Hallmark Channel and how Hallmark movies have very rather infamously promoted this sort of very bland, very conservative mindset where the characters are all white and the characters are all straight and
they're all Christian and they're all
upper middle class conservative families.
They all live in small town Midwest America.
It's sort of like what Disney does in that it's trying to predict depict this really very specific lifestyle as sort of like the real America. And I find that to be incredibly harmful in a lot of ways, especially when it comes to things like queer representation, because there aren't queer characters in these things. And you and Alonso were saying that there's been some evolution over the years, that they actually are starting to incorporate some representation. Whereas Dave White and I were just sort of sniffing at this entire thing.
Mm.
And to that point, it's... I'm not so concerned with where the back end of representation is. You know, it might be moving along, and that means that we are making some progress if you look at the most backwards and see that there's actually some progress going on there.
Yeah.
But catch up.
No, 100%. And that was not, and I'm sure I speak for both Alonzo and myself when I say that when we were talking about how Hallmark has been improving, I don't think either of us are saying that they've nailed it. But there was a time when it seemed like they would never even make the attempt. And so at the very least, progress should be noted and it should be encouraged along. Please, let's hurry this the fuck up.
Yeah.
So some credit where credit is due, but you'll get a lot more credit if you just fucking do the thing.
Yeah. So we've had 20 some years of hetero Hallmark Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Let's have 20 years of queer.
Please. Balance it out.
Straight years. Yeah.
Not straight years.
we've had 20 straight years. Now we want 20 queer years of romances, Christmas romances on the whole.
Let's do it. I'm down.
Make them as bland as you want. Just make them queer. Things have no flavor anyway. At least have queer characters.
Please.
So I admire that you're trying to sort of prank your bigoted aunt into being a little bit more open-minded. Mm-hmm. And I think... If there's more and more and more queer stories out there then your aunt needs to see them and understand that it's not okay to be a bigot, and it's okay to watch these stories and feel things for other human beings.
Yeah. Like they have different experiences than yours. Oh no!
Yeah, what a tragedy!
I could totally feel something for space aliens with laser swords, but people on the same planet as me.
But if those space aliens with laser swords kiss members of the same sex, oh my goodness!
Yeah, that's where the line is. It's ridiculous. Anyway.
Trying to think of other examples though.
Because
I'm trying to think of something that's a little bit more adult, because everything we've gone to is an animated series.
I was thinking of it's one where there's a lot of queer subtext early on, but then it gradually becomes text, and that would be the TV series of Hannibal.
Oh, do Hannibal and Will
relationship
fall in love?
They becomes increasingly romantic, yes. And by the end of it, it's hard to argue otherwise.
Well, do they kiss or hold hands? They become a couple.
They're called murder husbands.
Okay.
But there's also a lot more queer representation of the show beyond them. But regardless, fair enough. But that's just one that came to mind anyway.
Okay.
I don't know. There's a lot out there. There's a lot of TV out there, and it's hard to. It's one of those things where it's like, hey, tell a joke. Oh shit! Now I gotta think of a joke.
You might want to go back to the '90s when they were really pushing for representation, but only occasionally. You watch something like My So-Called Life, and there's a Party of Five, and there's a queer character or a queer moment in an otherwise show that's not queer. So
But let's be honest here. I don't think tokenism got us very far.
No, it did not.
No. It certainly was better than not having any representation.
It depends how mercenary you are in your views of representation. Yeah. Some people think any representation is okay, even tokenism. Some people think that doesn't go nearly far enough, fast enough, and. At the time, a lot of TV producers felt that this was sort of a way to ease into it. And if that's sort of your goal is to find somebody who's incredibly backwards, show them older TV. Show them something that's already a little bit dated, and try to get them to catch up that way.
All right, moving on.
Here's a letter from James Kozinides. Hello, James.
Hey, James.
Messrs. McCool and Bibithith.
Cool.
I'm sure that's a reference to something.
Okay.
I want to start this letter by thanking you for another excellent movie suggestion. I finished watching Werewolves Within.
Yay!
And it was quite the treat. I liked the Werewolves Within.
Really fun horror movie this year. Please go see it.
And this leads me to the topic of my letter. Do you, as film critics, find you know how movies are going to end long before the credits roll, simply because you are familiar with screenwriting conventions, yourselves having seen a lot of movies? Furthermore, how do you think your ability or inability to predict a film affects your opinion of that film? While not a working critic, I watch a ton of movies and find myself spotting twists early and often. Without going into spoilers, there's a bit in Werewolves Within that is brought up early on, so by the time it was mentioned again in the film, based on the established principle of setup, reinforcement, payoff.
Yep.
I knew it was likely to come up a third time, and that would only point to one person as the guilty party.
Right.
I know the term predictable is often used as a negative when discussing film. I remember that was one of Bibb's complaints about Knives Out, as he said he figured it out, who done it. But for me, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. I still loved Werewolves Within, despite knowing for 80% of the movie who we were looking for. And I still enjoyed Coco, despite knowing the twist as soon as they showed a photo without a face, to use another example.
Yeah, that one's pretty
kind of broadcast itself a little bit. For me, even if I see what the film is doing, I can appreciate it just the same as long as it's done well. Mm-hmm. But I also have trouble articulating the distinction. Anyways, just wanted to get your thoughts on those two questions. Love your show as always. Also, my own insecurities require that I mention I'm not one of those people who take 1,000 wild guesses on what's going to happen in any movie and is super smug when I'm right about one. Yeah. Those guys suck.
Yeah, well, that's just hedging your bets.
Little sign off, James.
James, thank you so much. We study movies a lot. I have a degree in screenwriting. I pay attention to story construction and the way that certain elements of a story are set up specifically so that they can pay off later. And so it's not uncommon for me to know where a movie is going. Some movies, it doesn't matter if you know where they're going. They're not going anywhere that's going to blow your mind. Rom-coms will end happily. Slasher movies will end with most people dead, you know? These are not shocks. Yeah. And so predicting the ending is actually the selling point. I want the ending to end the way I'm more or less expecting it to, because that's why I'm here today. Yeah. But some movies are mysteries. In the case of Knives Out, it's a straight-up whodunit. You gotta, you're trying to, you're actually like almost competing with that movie to see who's cleverer. Yeah. And that's true for a lot of mystery fiction, whether it's novels, TV, Columbo's, Columbo's an inversion of that, but like, you know, there's a lot of mystery TV where you're trying to figure out who the killer is.
I recommend, listeners, you seek out an author named Harry Stephen Keeler. Mm. He was a mystery author in the 50s, and he's sort of like the Ed Wood of the mystery novel genre, in that he wrote these incredibly bizarre, very bad mysteries. The one I've read, McSweeney's found it and republished it. It's called The Riddle of the Traveling Skull. And it's about a guy who wakes up on a bus. He fell asleep on a bus, and he gets home with his suitcase, opens it up, and there's a skull inside. There's a hole in the skull, and there's, like, notes of paper inside the skull. And he has to figure out what the riddle of this skull is. How did it get in his bag? And this is not his bag. Wait a minute. He switched it around, and it goes to, doctors who perform trepanation and, dead circus performers, and he travels and talks to all of these really bizarre characters. And about two chapters from the end, there's a splash page in the middle with a big skull drawn on it, and it says, "Stop reading. You have all the clues. You should be able to figure it out now." And now write down who you think it is.
That's fun.
And see if you're right reading that pipe. The problem is Harry Stephen Keeler is such a rotten author, you could never possibly guess, because the explanation makes no logical sense whatsoever. And he writes all these novels with really strange titles, like the Riddle of the Traveling Skull, The Case of the Transposed Legs, I Killed Lincoln at 3:17!
Nice.
Yeah, The Skull of the Waltzing Clown. You know, there's all these these are real books.
I really want to read all those books.
Yeah, sadly, a lot of them are really hard to track down. I think you can get some like through those like cheapy print on demand things through like Amazon.
Right.
But yeah, this idea that you should be able to figure it out right now is a big appeal of like a mystery.
Sure.
And a movie's never done that. They say, stop, you should be able to figure it out. Unless I'm watching a mystery, I'm not really big on being surprised.
Okay.
Like a big twist in a movie is never going to be its selling point.
It's never been done, but generally speaking.
It's definitely been done. Yeah. And movies do still surprise me, and it's especially nice when it's not meant to be seen coming.
Yeah.
There's a twist in the movie The Woman that you couldn't possibly see coming.
No.
That changes the context of everything, and when it comes out of the blue, it's like, oh, holy shit, this big surprise.
It's the scariest fucking thing.
So there are surprises like that that I really appreciate. If you don't know the story or anything about the Takashi Miike audition, watch that one without reading anything, because that one would benefit from being surprised.
But that's one where you're not supposed to predict it. It's just supposed to sort of come along.
When it comes to predicting movies, you can safely predict most movies, especially if you see a lot of them.
Yeah,
because screenplays tend to be written kind of in the same way, especially if you're familiar with the genre, or more specifically with a filmmaker.
Yeah,
you know how these things are probably gonna work out in a general sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And the fun is seeing how they get there.
True.
Even if you can predict it, sometimes it's fun just to watch it play out. You can predict it and they're still treating it as if it's a mystery, that's when it becomes a problem.
You know, someone was online the other day and they tweeted about, I don't know why people watch movies more than once. You already know how they end.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why we watch them.
I guess that is how some people, I suppose.
But it's not why the rest of us watch them, is my point. The ending isn't like, you know, the treasure at the end of the map.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to grab that treasure and then throw away the map. No, it's like the journey matters, but also the ending matters.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of movies out there where the ending is so satisfying or so scary or so bizarre that it intrigues us.
Mm-hmm.
That is satisfying to us, or it intrigues us and we want to revisit it over and over again. And as a result, you know, I already know how a movie I've already seen ends. If I want to see it again, that means I want to get to that ending again. I want to go on that journey and earn that ending all over again. And that can be very, very satisfying. When I'm watching a movie and a movie is formulaic enough that I can put it together pretty quick, or if it's trying to be sneaky and dang it, it activated the curiosity part of my brain and I start trying to outthink the movie because it's the point, it's a whodunit. There's two things that I want. I either want to be surprised, or I want them to... Well, actually, let me rephrase that. I want them to come up with the best ending. If the best ending is the ending that I predicted, I want that ending. If they come up with a better ending than that, I'm all for it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it can be frustrating. Like, I actually... I figured out... I remember the first time I saw the movie Scream, the original Scream, no idea. Everyone told me, you try to figure out who did it. And I'm like, okay. And one of the things I was paying attention to was who isn't around when the killer is killing. Mm. And once it's you know
fun,
the end...
It's a fun game to play with the movie Clue as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, who's in the room in that shot?
Exactly.
They're always like crowded together, so you kind of lose track sometimes.
But the twist in the movie Scream is such that that kind of traditional paying attention to the narrative to figure out who done it doesn't help, because they found a way around that. So they played completely fair. You just didn't know that that was a rule. And now, and once the rule is revealed, you're like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. That's really clever, actually. So that one I didn't see coming at all. And then Scream 4 came around many years later. And that one I figured out by like 40 minutes in. And that was really frustrating, because that one where I wasn't paying attention so much to like who wasn't around.
Uh-huh.
I was paying attention to who should be the protagonist of this movie and isn't getting a lot of screen time. And once I started putting that together, I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. Why the hell isn't this character more important? Why aren't we like doing... And then that became abundantly clear that, okay, we're going to go in this direction. And it's still a pretty good ending. I wasn't mad at it, but that one I got...
Scream 4, yeah.
That's a good movie. I'm not complaining. I was just like, that's how I got ahead of that one.
Mm.
So, yeah. But again, I don't want to be right.
Yeah.
I just want a good ending. If it's the ending I happen to see coming, great. That's a good ending. If it's the ending that I like, go for it. But what I want is you to come up with a satisfying ending.
Mm.
If that's satisfying because it's a twist or because it's formulaic, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Just satisfy me.
And I've said this before on our podcasts. I'm not spoiler phobic. I'm not going to spoil something for somebody else, because I know a lot of people.
Sometimes you do.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I spoil things because I don't think you should give a damn. And sometimes I spoil things because that's the point. Like, you wouldn't want to see it. If I need to spoil something to sell something to you, then I'm going to do that.
Hopefully people know that when we review movies on the critically acclaimed channel, we're typically expecting you to be familiar with them or to understand that we're going to be talking about them in detail. Some have twists that we will go out of our way to respect. Some are formulaic enough that we don't think it matters if you know how it ends, because we already know how it ends. It's a rom-com or whatever. And sometimes it's just desperately important that we talk about a plot point, because otherwise we can't talk about the film fairly.
Right.
So it's tricky. Sometimes it's hard to decide what's important, what's not.
But I'm not one of those people who likes to follow like the marketing, the previews of a film up to a point, and then like a few days before say, don't give me any more information.
Yeah.
I have enough now.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to give us any more through previews. I don't care. I don't care if you spoil a big surprise for me. Mm-hmm. Usually if it's presented well, then I'm going to enjoy it anyway.
Yeah. I had the ending of Citizen Kane spoiled for me before I saw it. It's still brilliant.
A lot of people have seen a movie like Psycho.
Famously, a lot of people know. Yeah.
And in fact, there have been studies on this that, going way back, if you know the ending to something before you go in, you tend to enjoy it more. This is
kinda weird.
It sounds weird, but
sounds
it's
a little
true.
Counterintuitive, doesn't it?
You'd think so, but if something is reliant on a twist, and then you watch it again and you realize, oh, this is about the twist, that's not a very good story.
Yeah.
If it's something that has a good twist, then that's something a little bit different. Think about studying Shakespeare. They usually give you a synopsis before you start reading the play.
Yeah.
So you know how it's going to end. You know what happens to Romeo and Juliet. It's not going to be a big surprise.
Right.
But you can still really appreciate and enjoy Romeo and Juliet and see how it leads to that ending. And you get to see the function of the entire machine a little bit better, knowing where it's going to go.
I just remember one of my favorite lines in The Simpsons is when Milhouse said, we were like Romeo and Juliet, but we ended in tragedy.
But we ended in tragedy. So when it comes to predicting endings, you can do that. Is that a bad thing? No. Yeah. No, it's not. A story well told is a story well told.
Yeah, and the idea that movies are meant to be kept a complete secret from you is a made-up convention that's really recent, actually.
And it's based on advertising and marketing.
It's based on marketing. Yeah. It's based on creating a sense of mystique around something. You know,
don't give away the ending.
Yeah, and then occasionally there's something that's actually legitimately worth being a little protective about, because damn it, the ending is so good. Mm. Like, imagine if everyone knew the twist ending to like The Sixth Sense before it came out, might not have had such an impact. People might not have left the theater and going, "Oh my God, I have to tell everybody to go see this movie and not ruin it," you know?
The first time I remember that happening, to bring it up again, is The Crying Game.
There you go.
That was a big part of the marketing was, don't tell the secret of The Crying Game.
Yeah, The Usual Suspects had a marketing campaign like that, you know?
It's got a big twist in it. Yeah. Don't tell what the secret is.
Sixth Sense had one as well, and that can be exciting, but not every movie is designed like that. Mm. And sometimes movies are just movies, damn it. You know, they're not trying to be a damn puzzle box. So, anyway, we got time for one more. Let's do it.
Okay, here is a letter from CW.
Hi, CW.
Hello, CW.
Luca says hi. He's on my lap right now.
Yeah, Luca is on mic as well. Luca is not a loud purrer, so you're not going to hear purring.
No.
Hey, Bibbs and Rockmeister. Enjoying all the podcasts, per usual. I have particularly been loving All Our Yesterdays. As someone who has watched maybe 10 full hours of Star Trek, with six of them being the J.J. Abrams verse, I have been getting knowledge of a pop culture institution I have yet to have the desire to undertake myself. For instance, I found myself shocked to learn that we are moving on to Next Generation, as I always assumed the original cast films all concluded before the show began.
Oh, yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah, they made four movies before they started The Next Generation.
And then a couple more with the original cast during The Next Generation,
I wrote today in regards to your remarks about branding in Space Jam.
Mm.
Another Space Jam letter. And previously in films like Flora and Ulysses. Flora and Ulysses was a superhero film about a young girl who teams up with a hyper-intelligent squirrel.
A squirrel with like superhuman strength, or super squirrel strength, I guess.
And a lot of that movie was devoted to quoting Avengers movies and playing with Star Wars toys.
Yeah,
and
like
really bizarre.
People couldn't like ring a doorbell without the doorbell being like the Imperial March or something. And it was always something Disney owned.
Yeah.
So
kind of like showing off what they bought, essentially.
Yeah. It was just really pervasive and distracting. Yeah.
I find myself noticing it more and more in film, and much like you gents, find it more and more annoying the less it has to do with the story. However, I recently discovered an almost reverse instance of this and had to share it. Hmm. On Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Ah.
Another callback to earlier. They have an annual heist episode where they capture the flag style to steal items in an elaborate fashion.
That's so damn good.
I think I need to watch this show.
You would love that show. You would love that. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is some, I mean, there's some, it's weird because it's a really like positive
cop show, but
like once you get into the characters and everything, it's really great. Yeah. And their annual Halloween heist episodes are superb. They're so clever.
The items always change. Sometimes it's someone's watch. Sometimes it's a Schmodown style championship belt, or, as Andrew Brower put it, a championship cummerbund. What pants have belt loops that size? Etc. In its most recent season, the items they were going for were infinity gems that would fit into one of those Thanos gauntlets that were everywhere.
Ah.
And that would be really annoying if that were done on ABC. But Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a show that started on Fox before moving its last two seasons to NBC Universal, where it was initially developed. It's never been a part of the Mouse House. So the decision then becomes about character, and yes, it makes 100% sense that Andy Samberg's character would be one of the millions that found Infinity War pretty rad. Thus, a pop cultural shout-out was used as a character-defining trait as opposed to a commercial for the studio's property. I loved it. Can you gentlemen think of other examples of people reaching across studio lines for the betterment of a piece of art?
Yeah.
Thank you. Hope you're staying safe and well, CW.
So product placement, again, product placement in its, like, central form is when a movie makes an agreement with the makers of a certain product or a certain movie or whatever to highlight that product in the movie in exchange for money.
Yeah, and it goes way, way back. Watch Joan Crawford movies.
Oh, yeah.
How often do you see Pepsi in the background?
Yeah, she was, like, married to, like, the CEO of Pepsi or something.
So
Pepsi's all over the place because it's product placement. The product gets to be significantly featured in such a way that hopefully it's done in such a way that people aren't super aware of it and aren't aware they're being pandered to, but sometimes they don't give a shit.
Films put out by Sony are like the most guilty of that.
They are unapologetic a lot of times.
If you saw the 2016 Ghostbusters film, it's like, that's all over that film. Yeah.
But it can't be
all this advertising in that movie.
But the trick with it, though, and the trick with it is... we live in a world where there is constant advertising everywhere, isn't there?
So like, is it product placement if it's just taking place in a branded universe?
And there actually is like a line where you don't have to even contact like the maker of a brand for permission to use their stuff if it would naturally occur in the background. So like, if you shot a scene in a supermarket, you might play it safe and try to go with generic brands, but... Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if it's just two people talking and in the background you can kind of make out a box of Apple Jacks, the Apple Jacks can't complain about that because that's where the Apple Jacks would be. Mm. It's perfectly natural that that would be the case.
Sometimes they mention products by name, and it's difficult to say if they were paid by the company to feature that product in their movie, or if the makers of the movie simply have an open affection for that product.
Yeah.
A case in point, Luca, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's all about Vespas.
Very specifically, Vespa is not a type of motorcycle. Vespa is a brand.
It's a brand, and I'm pretty certain in the case of Luca, they were going for something very patently Italian in the screenplay.
Yeah.
Rather than, because it takes place in Italy, rather than Vespa coming to them and saying, "Hey, could you feature our scooters in your movie?"
Now, I'm sure they entered into an agreement with Vespa so that it would be okay. Like, hey, listen, we're going to treat Vespa like it's the coolest thing in the world. Can't help but feel like product placement in that movie, but it is the movie's art's in a good place, so it's hard to be mad about that.
Same with in Wayne's World, they talk about Fender guitars specifically. Yeah. It's like, well, that's just sort of common parlance with rock snobs. You know, this kind of guitar is very, very good, and we all know the brands rather than make something up.
There's actually a good example of the good and bad of this in the Tim Story Fantastic Four movies. Which are really mixed bags. Like, there's a couple of good things about each of them, but neither of them are particularly good movies.
I like the story and the acting and the scripts are pretty bad, but I love the tone of those movies.
The tone is pretty solid.
It's kind of light sitcom tone.
Chris Evans and Michael Chiklis are very well cast in those movies. They're really, really wonderful in those films. And But there's a gag in those movies where Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, played by Chris Evans... has, much like Captain Amazing in Mystery Men, sold ad space on his costume. So he's got like little patches from his various sponsors. And like, I buy that he would do that. Mm. So it makes sense for the character. But then, towards the end of Fantastic Four, The Rise of Silver Surfer, there's a bit where the Fantastic Four are like trapped halfway around the world and they can't get out. And Reed Richards sends a signal out to the Fantasticar. Which we know from the comics is their like flying car, and it could travel halfway around the world in like half an hour or something. Yeah,
that sort of thing seems unimpressive in like bigger superhero universe, but the Fantastic Car was a big deal.
Yeah, so he sends a signal out to the Fantastic Car to come from America. I think they're in like China or something, and it comes all over, and it's like, and Johnny Storm's like super impressed, and he's like, "Oh my god, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen!" And then he sees
Is it like a Pontiac logo?
It's like a Dodge or whatever like that. He sees like it's branded. Like you made up this car, but it's got like a car brand on it. And Johnny Storm looks like, does it have a Hemi? And then Reed Richards says, of course. And I'm like, fuck you, Reed Richards would not. A, Reed Richards would invent something even better than that. Oh. B, he would not geek out about that. Yeah. That's Johnny Storm might. Granted, Reed Richards would not. Yeah. So that's one where it just... felt really false, even though like, and that was clear. That one was clear product placement.
And we live in a, you said we live in a branded world, and a lot of brands have a certain kind of meaning. There's a movie out there called The World's Fastest Indian, and it's about India, the brand of motorcycle. They put the brand right in the title of that movie.
It's actually about that motorcycle, though. That was a real life incident.
It's a real life incident, and it's about a real fellow who broke a land speed record on this motorcycle. He altered himself. It's actually a very sweet movie.
It's actually good. Yeah, I like that movie,
But, you know, if you were to call it The World's Fastest Motorcycle, that's not... First of all, the title doesn't have the same ring.
No.
And secondly, Indian has meaning to it. Mm-hmm. Indian brand motorcycles mean something to gearheads.
Yeah.
So when car makes and models are pointed out in movies... outside of James Bond, they tend to have some sort of connection to them. That, like, there's actually significance to that particular brand.
Yeah.
that Andy Samberg wants to race around looking for Infinity Gems. It's very topical. It sounds like something Disney would pay for.
Right.
But yeah, I think
his character is like,
if he's the one, if he's the only one who gets really excited about Infinity Gems and everybody else is kind of indifferent.
Yeah.
That speaks to his character.
Exactly. I haven't seen that episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I haven't seen the last season, but, that's a character who decided to become a cop because he saw Die Hard. In fact, they actually, there's an episode where they went to Los Angeles and
he went to that building.
They had to go to the Nakatomi building and end up getting locked on the top floor.
That's really funny.
And it was all in character because
that's really close to us, by the way. It's Century City. It's like a
5 minute drive.
It's like 3 miles away from us.
Yeah, it's like super, well, yeah, in LA, three miles can be more than a 5 minute drive sometimes. But like, if you know the trick, you take Olympic, it's easy. Yeah, so it fits. We live in a branded world. Brands are everywhere. Advertising is everywhere. To pretend it's not can sometimes be more distracting than just admitting that it's out there. But we all know when the line is crossed. We all know when there is no reason to see a logo in this shot. You frame the shot specifically so that the Coca-Cola logo would be in here, or the Macintosh logo, or whatever.
Sometimes it's lampshaded for hilarious purposes. Sure. Like
Wayne's World.
Wayne's World is an example. Yeah. I will not bow to any sponsor. And he poses with a Pizza Hut slice.
Yeah.
In Looney Tunes Back in Action, a good example of this is the Bugs, Daffy, and the two human characters are lost in a desert. And what should appear in the mirage but like a branded Walmart?
Yeah.
And so let's just go to the Walmart. And it turns out it's actually there because they're everywhere. And as they're walking away, sort of like, ooh, I'm glad we got these Walmart drinks. Yes, I have this Walmart blanket. It's a good thing Walmart paid us so much money to say their name so much. Like, actually say it. It's a little annoying, but at least they made a joke
out of it. It's hard to be mad at that one.
Yeah.
You know, because they leaned into it. They made it into a thing. Mm. But yeah, sometimes it's embarrassing. Sometimes it's, but it is what it is. Mm. Other times, I will say this, there are also some movies that actually incorporate it into the narrative and the themes. We've talked a lot about how Kevin Smith built a lot of his career around Star Wars speeches.
Yeah.
People actually like working class Joes just looking for meaning in the most mainstream pop culture entertainment and desperately trying to find something and kind of succeeding.
finding interesting ways to look at these films.
Yeah. And I think, it's Clerks definitely wasn't paid by Disney. In fact, I'm sure, or I guess that would have been the Fox at the time. I think Fox probably would have been very, very happy if they'd left us out of this, because that's a very profane film. But at the same time, it's something people would talk about, isn't it? You know? That's a great question, though. I like the, positive product placement. It's something we don't talk about enough.
One last thing, and I think this is something I might have brought up before, but this is a big pet peeve of my wife. She's a beer enthusiast. Very refined taste in beer, and she pointed this out to me, how unnatural it is, because I don't frequent bars.
Yeah.
In movies, when people go into bars, they sit down and they say, what are you having? I'll have a beer. What? What kind of beer?
It's a bar. We have dozens of beers.
Is there a brand you like? So she likes, and she can always spot, like, oh, this one was clearly filmed in Canada, when they sit down and they say they want a Labatt's. You know, it's like, clearly that nobody's going to a bar in America and ordering Labatt's.
I remember there was the commentary, I think, for Clerks, and they talked about how in Clerks, you know, they got away with having brands because it was set in a convenience store, so you can see, like, a Zagnut bar or something in the background, but many of the times a character would come into the shop in the movie Clerks, and what they would order is cigarettes. They didn't want to, like, name check a lot of cigarettes and give cigarettes a lot of promotion.
Marlboro gets a lot of
traction
here.
So, like, they ended up just saying a pack of cigarettes in that one, and the justification was they're all probably regulars and he knows what their brand is. Was their justification for why they thought that was fine. I think, is that the one where they made up the fictional cigarette brand Nails?
No, I don't know.
Nails, I think, was a brand that Kevin, I think it was a Kevin Smith brand.
I know that
Quentin Tarantino came up with Red Apples.
Red Apple cigarettes.
That's the fake cigarettes that he's okay with, like, because you want to promote a real brand. You come up with a fake thing for Bruce Willis to order.
I know in Clerks, the chewing gum was a made-up brand.
Chewy's gum.
Chewy's gum was something that Kevin Smith made up.
Let me see if I can. Someone invented the Nails. No, it is. It's Clerks.
It was Clerks.
Yeah, it was. Nails is the name of a fake cigarette company.
Which is, play on
Nail in Your Coffin.
Well, cigarettes used to be called coffin nails, and yeah. I'm not sure if people don't really smoke openly so much anymore. So, no. At least not as frequently as they did, you know, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Or even 10 years ago. It's really
I saw somebody smoking like in their car yesterday, and it looked so weird to me. Yeah. Like I'm so unused to seeing people just sitting there puffing away on a cigarette.
Remember when cars used to come with ashtrays?
Ashtrays and cigarette lighters.
Weird. Yeah.
They used to be big plot points. We watched my wife and I watched a slasher movie recently called The Mutilator. and at the end of the movie, when they try to get away from the killer, they use that little cigarette lighter to burn the killer's hand as they're reaching in through the car window.
That was
something you could do. It's like, you have to explain to a modern audience what that even is now.
There was a plot point in the movie Guarding Tess with Shirley MacLaine and Nicolas Cage, where Shirley MacLaine was, she's like a former first lady, and he's a Secret Service agent who's assigned to protect her, and he thinks it's a crap assignment. He doesn't want to be there, and they hate each other, and it's actually a sweet movie, but towards the end, she gets kidnapped, and the chauffeur gets, like, branded by some mysterious, like, terrorist sect or something that kidnapped the First Lady, and eventually he realizes that that's not, like, some kind of creepy brand, that's actually a mark from a cigarette lighter.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's totally different. Okay. Yeah, it was a good little clue there. It happened real, real well. Spoilers for a 30-year-old movie you weren't going to watch anyway.
Now that you know about it, maybe you'll watch it.
It's actually pretty good. But anyway, that's it for We've Got Mail this week. Thank you, everybody, who wrote in. We're sorry if we didn't get to your emails. Again, we get a lot. We try to do our best, and you know us. We like to talk. Mm. If you want to email for a future episode, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Once again, that is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You can also, if you were so inclined, write us an actual letter.
A physical letter on a piece of paper.
We have a P.O. box.
Yeah. If you're going to handwrite it, just... write legibly.
That would help, yeah.
Or print it out. But yeah, we have a P.O. box. P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. Make it out to me or to William or to the Critically Acclaimed Network.
Or whoever you want, really. It's in our mailbox. It's
actually like if you go to the post office. You can't just address it to anybody.
Otherwise, I was thinking of the actual like inside letter, but yes.
Oh, well, inside the letter, yeah.
Yeah, but on the actual like letter, it needs to say our name or the company.
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565.
Yeah.
L.A., California, 90064. Yeah, and we'll read those letters on the podcast as well.
Yeah. Also, we're on Twitter. At Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Cycles.
As we've mentioned a few times on this podcast, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. That's where you can find our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays, where we review every single episode of Star Trek in order. We're already over 100 episodes in, and we're just about to start Star Trek The Next Generation.
That's right. The pilot is our next episode.
So if you sign up now, if you haven't signed up before, you get that entire back catalog. A lot of stuff. And again, I'd like to remind everybody that if you want us to consider doing Columbo as a Patreon series, if that's something you would consider signing up to the Patreon for, please let us know. Feel free to just tweet us. Probably the best way to do that. At Critic Acclaim. We'd love to hear from you. If we get enough people saying they jump on board, well, damn, I guess we probably have to, won't we? maybe not right away, but we will definitely put it in the to-do pile.
In the hopper.
I'd be very eager to. It's just a matter of making sure we have the time. So we would do it as soon as we could. I'm at William Bibbiani. He's at Whitney Seibold. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, we have a soap shop, or at least M. Lopez da Silva and I do. Head on over to Salt Cat Soap, at Salt Cat Soap on Instagram and Twitter. Check out our Etsy store. It's on Etsy. Look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We sell designer soaps. They are smelling great. They scrub up nice. We got shampoo bars, we got bath salts, we got lotions, and they are designer soaps. They make great gifts. A lot of people have been sending them as gifts. That's very flattering. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who has bought the soap. Thank you, everybody who's left a review. It means the world to us. And I guess that's it. So thank you, everybody, for listening to this show. Hope you enjoy all the other shows. And sincerely yours, these guys.